Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And this is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White with host Jay Moran, and we are continuing our discussion about Project 2025. Joining us today is Dr. Michael Nyman, professor of critical media studies and journalism at Buffalo State University and the University at Buffalo. Dr. Nyman, thank you again for being back on.
Not the University at Buffalo.
Not University at Buffalo? Just no. Buffalo State?
Just Buffalo State.
Just Buffalo State.
Yeah.
Just Buffalo State.
Is there?
Do you want to restart that?
We'll do it in post.
Yeah, okay. We'll do it in post.
Okay, great. We'll do it in post.
Okay.
Well, doctor, thank you for being back on with us.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, Project 2025. This is a topic that we've been discussing with other people. We're glad to get your viewpoints on it as well. And I think there's a lot of conversation that we can go with in this. And let's just start off with just a general question. You know, your thoughts about it and how it kind of reflects not only what we're seeing in the election, but also in American society today as well. Why don't you take us through some of your thoughts?
Okay, sure. And, you know, the lens that I'm looking at it through is a critical lens based on the work that I do as a faculty member, not just, you know, in the communication department teaching journalism and critical media studies, but also in women and gender and sexuality studies and in Africana studies, you know, teaching race, class, you know, teaching, you know, stories of race, class, gender, and sexuality in the media and in popular culture. So I'm looking at it, and there's a number of things that I think is really important to concentrate on. So rather than give an overview of the entire 920-page, you know, project, I'm looking at certain things that kind of jumped out at me. So Project 2025, it sets out a blueprint to expand presidential power, to give a president direct control over, for instance, the Justice Department. That includes the FBI and the federal judiciary. It knocks down guardrails that would impede a president from misusing, you know, the former arms of justice to persecute political opponents. And I say former arms of justice because once you start doing what, for instance, Donald Trump has threatened to do with the Justice Department, then it goes from being an arm of justice to an arm of persecution. So once these guardrails are knocked down and the president has more direct control over the operations of the Justice Department, they can then use it to persecute political opponents, which is something that Trump had tried unsuccessfully to do during his first term. So for context, so far in this year's presidential campaign, former President Trump has threatened that if elected back to office this year, he'd somehow jail, Kamala Harris and some of her supporters, including donors. I mean, this is like, you know, so just for disclosure, I've donated some money to the Harris campaign.
Okay.
Never before in my life have I ever felt that I'm threatened with jail for donating money to a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's caveats. Trump is certainly not a stupid man, right? So, you know, in these statements, you know, he'll couch it in, you know, criminal donations or improper donations. But what is criminal and what is improper is going to be defined by the Justice Department.
Right.
So, yeah. So Trump also proposed, you know, rather recently creating military tribunals to indict, you know, former President Barack Obama and congressional members of the bipartisan House committee that investigated the January 6, 2021 insurrection, like, for starters. I mean, if you see me, like, you know, kind of, you know, having trouble actually articulating this verbally, it's because I've usually used these terms and told these kind of stories in referring to other countries.
Authoritarian countries,
mm-hmm. right? You know, countries with collapsing democracies and so on. So to even say, you know, that a presidential candidate is proposing creating military tribunals to, you know, indict the former president of the United States and members of the congressional committee, you know, bipartisan congressional committee that investigated January 6th, you know, I'm stumbling in my words.
Right.
You know, this is not really, it's always pleasant to see you.
You know? Yeah, right.
But this is not really a pleasant conversation at all.
If I could jump in for just a second, you know, you said, you know, when you read about this, you know, you think about other countries who have crumbling democracies. What does this say about our democracy?
Well, we are at an inflection point. You know, we have some fantastic, strong, you know, powerful movements to protect democracy. The fact that we're even talking about threats to our democracy is good news, because there have always been threats to our democracy, and we've always fended them off. But we've always avoided, you know, using terms like authoritarian when referring to our own country. It goes with that kind of "it can't happen here," you know, mentality. Mm-hmm. It's part of American exceptionalism that not only, you know, do we, you know, as Americans feel ourselves to be above the fray in so many areas, you know, these things just don't apply to us, but we kind of feel that our democracy is indestructible. So we don't really, you know, we don't really worry about it.
So dispelling that notion that, well, someone's going to win, we'll still be America afterwards, this will still be the United States. From this perspective, you're saying, no, there's more to it than that. There's going to be, based on what Project 2025 is saying, and of course, the Trump campaign, which, again, we should mention that the Trump campaign has somewhat tried to distance itself from Project 2025. But you're saying that there are real, these are significant existential threats to democracy here in the United States.
Last night, I taught my race, class, gender, and sexuality in media class. And what we discussed in that class is, you know, among other things, you know, the policies that maintain and perpetuate intergenerational wealth disparities. And I use that Daria Reutemeyer's book. She's an economic historian, you know, to actually talk about a lot of these things. We spoke about these things last time I was on, right, you know, your show. But I gave it the caveat that we could not be having this conversation if I was teaching in Florida.
Mm.
Or I believe Texas.
Or Texas, right.
Right. And not that they would come in and lock me up, but that I might not be working there the next day, you know. That so it's not necessarily at this point a criminal infraction, although people have talked about that, but it's just prohibited. You know, it's prohibited in public educational institutions. So I never thought I'd be saying that, you know, about another state in my country. I teach a media literacy course that's online. So theoretically, somebody in Florida or Texas can take that class because they can't take it in their own states. Hmm. Because, again, because of, you know, how we talk about, you know, the role of media in perpetuating, you know, racist policies and racism and so on. But looking at this plan and the election coming up, Donald Trump claims to have no connection to the plan. and he insists that he has no idea what's in it. And, you know, I don't really think he read it, you know, and of course it's 920 pages. I think I'm, you know, prone to believe him on this, that he doesn't know what's in it. But what we do know is that the document, whether or not Trump acknowledges the document acknowledges Trump. So it's a blueprint for a president, you know, to what they should be doing, starting with the first day that they're in office. And, you know, what we can see is that the document, you know, dozens of former Trump administration officials helped write Project 2025. Right. And over the course of its 920 pages, they name-checked Trump 312 times. So it doesn't really matter if Trump knows about the document. You know, the document clearly seems to have Trump in mind. During his term of president, Trump had hit legal roadblocks when he tried to increase executive power. He was stymied by a slew of federal civil servants who had signed an oath of office, oaths of office, to defend the Constitution. And they did. You know, even if it infuriated the president, they defended the Constitution. And that's why Trump was unable, he was really, for the, you know, during his first presidency, unable to achieve most of his goals as far as creating an imperial presidency. They were able to block Trump's illegal moves because they had civil service protection, which is kind of like, you know, you compare that to academic tenure,
right?
Job protection, so they could actually do their jobs. So this also means they won their positions through open, merit-based, you know, job searches. Merit-based hires, that's a conservative ideology, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do a national search, these are the people that have the strongest credentials, they're hired, they have civil service, you know, protections, so they can't really be fired without a reason. And once, you know, once they're in office, you know, they have those protections specifically designed into their job so they can carry out their duties. Project 2025 proposes to eliminate this federal civil service protection, you know, and basically giving the president the power to fire government officials for enforcing U.S. laws, you know, against a rogue presidency. And also, they become political appointments as opposed to civil service hires. So it's no longer a competitive search. It's they come up through political organizations. They have shared political ideology. So they're not going in there as civil servants who have sworn an oath to protect the Constitution, and that is the main purpose of what they're doing there. But they go in there as political players with a political agenda, and that political agenda, you know, just reading over Project 2025 at various different junctures is at odds with the way I interpret the U.S. Constitution and, you know, the ideals of our democracy.
And they're being trained already on what Project 2025 is, and so they're being trained to come up through the ranks and be ready for these appointments should Trump get into office.
Yes, I would assume so, and I know that, you know, there are training institutes, you know, but it's not so much that they're going to be trained to do this, it's that they are political appointments who are hired to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they are trained to do this, you know, if we can document that, that, you know, makes it just that much quicker. And I think that this comes in, you know, kind of like a blitzkrieg. You know, there's a whole bunch of, you know, football analogies I should be using.
Right. That's fine.
You know, So despite mentioning Trump 312 times, and this is kind of the scary thing, Project 2025... In my mind, isn't really about Trump, per se. It's about consolidating power. And the only way you consolidate power, you know, in a democracy, the way they're describing, is by undermining the very notion of democracy. And it's all clearly written and laid out. So this is a policy statement that says everything. And it's the same thing, you know, one of the things about the Trump presidency is that Trump oftentimes, in clear language, says exactly what he's going to do. And people don't listen to him. You know, they say that, well, this is his style of speaking. I'm like, no, he's telling you what he's going to do. He's telling you that he's going to use the Justice Department to persecute his political enemies. He doesn't use the word persecute. He might use the word prosecute.
Right.
It's all, you know, clearly laid out. Where Trump fits into Project 2025 is he is the tool to enable that consolidation of power. But, you know, it doesn't have to be Trump who's doing it. I'll get more to that.
Okay.
But Project 2025, it's written by the Heritage Foundation. And in a nutshell, a lot of, you know, students particularly have been asking me, you know, what is the Heritage Foundation? And I figure, like, one of the ways that I like to write and I like to teach is just, you know, put it into plain English. You know, I'm from South Brooklyn, right? So, you know, it's the Heritage Foundation is a right-wing political advocacy and action organization. This is what, like, wonks will call a think tank. Mm-hmm. So we often hear the term think tank.
Certainly.
And then, you know, in popular culture, we think of Shark Tank or, you know, but, you know, what is a think tank, right? What they do is they draw plans, they influence politicians, and they make things happen. And they do this on a national level, they do this on a state level, and they are very effective at doing it. So if you look at, you know, history, in Trump's previous administration, he and his administration enacted 2/3 of the demands that were made by the Heritage Foundation during his presidency. So they gave him a list, and it's not a new relationship,
right?
You know, and they're not a new organization. They gave him a list of things to do in the first presidency, and 2/3 of them were done. That's a really good record. That's, you know, pretty impressive.
I'm sorry. But it, just to highlight that idea that when Donald Trump was president, that he followed their notions or their demands, for lack of a better term. Does the Heritage Foundation, you were talking about before about how Donald Trump kind of has this way of talking where he says things and then his defenders come to him and say, well, he maybe didn't really mean that or whatever the case may be. The Heritage Foundation sees in him as a tool to help them garner this political power, to consolidate this political power.
Because he has been a tool in the past. So it's a pretty good bet that if he's reelected, he would be that tool in the future. And it's worked out well for them.
But could you fit any other politician with a demagogic bent in that position?
Oh, yeah.
A Ron DeSantis or a J.D. Vance?
Absolutely. You know, Project 2024 is a blueprint to supercharge their agenda by recommending an action plan for a compliant president. Is clearly written with a second Trump presidency in mind, but the plan being much larger than Trump, you know, a Ron DeSantis, a Greg Abbott, a J.D. Vance could likely, you know, work out just as well or better. And I think that, you know, we're on the same page because, you know, 2 out of the 3 names you mentioned, I've scribbled down in my notes,
right?
You know, that it's not really about Trump. And, you know, I think this is very important in the Republican Party, is that Trump is a fantastic tool because Trump is able to sell, you know, what is basically an agenda, you know, funded by billionaires that cuts taxes for the ultra rich and so on. And we're not really here to talk about
the
Trump,
agenda.
Yeah. And then sell it to working class people. And that, you know, Trump is very much like George W. Bush in this regards. George W. Bush was a blue blood from Connecticut who moved to governor and got elected Texas, you know, with a kind of Will Rogers persona. He's the guy, kind of guy you'd want to have a beer with, you know, and was able to, you know, mispronounce his words and misspeak so we can all feel some kind of kinship with them.
Yeah, folksy.
And that Trump, you know, I mean— Trump was born, you know, with not a silver spoon or, you know, much more rich than that.
A platinum spoon.
Platinum spoon in his right butt mouth, you know. But, you know, he grew up with privilege. You know, he was, you know, born into a real estate empire that, you know, owned a large part of Brooklyn. So that, you know, suddenly he's, you know, here, you know, marketed as a warrior of the working class. And, you know, his actions in his first presidency did not support the working class. You know, he's spoken out, you know, strongly against unions and strikes and so on. So, you know, it's a house of cards. But it's a very useful house of cards. And that is very useful for people like the authors of Project 2025. But Trump is basically a tool. And once seizing power, I think they'd like to, you know, not have that tool around any longer and have a shinier tool that doesn't have as many rough edges on it. You know, but right now this works for them. And because of the power that Trump has with his base, which is now the base of the Republican Party, a lot of politicians cannot have any influence over him. So he's kind of out of control and unpredictable, you know. So, yeah, but for the time being, this plan seems to be written with him in mind, but he's totally not necessary for it to be executed. You just need a president. I think he's way more electable than, you know, and the people we just mentioned, if they were running for president. You know, DeSantis, you know, people see him as being kind of creepy. Greg Abbott, he's just, you know, look, as a whole, you know, he might not get reelected in Texas necessarily.
Right.
So to understand Project 2025, we need to look at the history of authoritarian movements over the past century.
This is an interesting part of this, really, isn't it? That,
yeah.
That it does connect in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been using the works of Jason Stanley because, again, it's very, very direct, well-written, you know, easy to read. He's a Yale University professor and the grandson of Holocaust survivors. In 2018, he wrote a book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And it very clearly outlines a common playbook used by authoritarians and authoritarian regimes over the past century around the world. So you start, you know, and here's a rough list. You know, you create a mythic past, you know, and, you know, make, you know, when we were great, you know. So you look at the things like, you know, the Nazis and make Germany great again. So you create this mythic past. And, you know, while you can say, you know, the United States is a great nation now, you know, so make us great again would deny that greatness that you see within our diversity and our movements and what we've been able to accomplish and the struggles that we have here, you know. But our history, you know, you don't have to go very far back in history to see when America was not great for different populations of Americans. So, you know, and so there's a mythic history where everything was always wonderful. You need to build then down, you know, moving down the list, build a propaganda machine. And ultimately, you want to move towards what Putin's created in Russia, which is not just, you know, having a strong propaganda machine, but having a totally dominant propaganda machine, you know, just remove all other things. And he was able to do that by having his oligarch friends, who allegedly were turned into oligarchs by the corrupt redistribution of state resources after the fall of communism. So he had his oligarch friends buy the different media operations because, you know, in Russia, like in the United States, most of your media is not public. Most of it is in private hands. So we've seen that, too. You know, where we have members of our own oligarch class, you know, buying up major media organizations. And then use that propaganda machine, moving down the list, to erode a common reality. So before you even go after democracy, you go after reality. You attack the very notion of truth. So it gets kind of really, you know, Orwellian there. And to erode our common reality, our notion of truth, what's real. So you see this, you know, with climate change. You go back, you know, climate change was not a debate. It was a consensus. Almost every climate scientist, you know, agreed. And you had thousands of different studies that all reinforced and validated each other. So then what you do is you create doubt. and you just, you know, get a pseudoscientist and elevate them in one of the media organizations that becomes part of a larger propaganda machine. And suddenly we have what politicians call the climate debate. But you can't really debate what we're seeing.
Right.
Right. But it's a debate. So that stalls climate policy. It has stalled climate policy, a strong climate policy, for 40 years. What we're seeing now is worse than what was predicted. So you use it to, you know, you use your machine, your propaganda machine to erode a common reality.
Hey, we're going to just take a time out right here, Dr. Nyman. We'll come back with more of our discussion. Dr. Michael Nyman, Buffalo State University, with us. This is What's Next on WBFO.
At Buffalo Toronto Public Media, community is at the heart of everything we do. Whether we're dancing alongside you at Porch Fest, inviting you in for a tough conversation about systemic racism, teaching you about what to do when someone overdoses, or entertaining you with free concerts in our performance space. Engaging with and serving our community is our top priority. This is Public Media.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Klein Hand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's music hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And we are back with What's Next. Thomas O'Neill White here with Jay Moran and Dr. Michael Nyman, professor at Buffalo State University. Dr. Nyman, you were on a roll talking about authoritarianism. Let's get you back on track.
Okay. I was talking about, you know, the common playbook. I had a bullet point list here that authoritarians and authoritarian regimes have used over the last century. So the next one on my list is undermining intellectualism.
Oh,
right.
We'll certainly see that.
Right. So, you know, empiricism can't safeguard, you know, reality if it's been undermined. So basically, if we're struggling for, you know, we're struggling to maintain a common reality so that we can have policy debates and discussions, you erode a common reality. You let somebody go into a debate, and, you know, we saw this with the vice presidential debate, you know, and with the presidential debate, you know, where two of the candidates were complaining about being fact-checked, you know, and complaining about, you know, media organizations, news organizations not wanting to repeat misinformation as a form of censorship, you know, is that what you do is you flood the information, you know, universe with misinformation, and then reality ceases to exist and everything becomes, you know, becomes a debate. So instead of debating policy based on a common reality, which is what democracy is all about and what democracy lives and thrives on, instead, I find that most political debates right now are about reality as opposed to being about policy. So that is, you know, that undermines intellectualism. Intellectualism gives us the tools to really think about things deeply. So empiricism, which basically means, you know, evidence-based arguments, evidence-based, you know, empiricism is what normally is used to protect democracy. But if intellectualism becomes a quote-unquote like elite, you know, right?
Which is
and
a common
you start
phrase,
using
right?
various different, you know, names to undermine, you know, what we're doing right here, right now, then you have, you know, you can't really safeguard, reality. The next thing, and this is the big one on this list, is you rhetorically divide us into an us and a them. And then you make the us very frightened of the them. And your main tool is fear. Because when we become frightened, we act irrationally. And when we become frightened, we oftentimes will act against our own best interests because of this perceived greater fear, which is mostly created. So you divide the world into an us and a them, and then vilify the them. And this has been every authoritarian movement has always created scapegoats. Mm-hmm. This month, you know, last month, it's Haitian immigrants.
Right.
You know, it's no accident that it's Haitian immigrants, because, you know, Haitian immigrants are black, and they are black people who don't really have, you know, the strongest connections to other black American groups, and that they have, you know, because of their cultural differences, they have always been stigmatized. Their religion has been marginalized, mm-hmm. and so on. So culturally, we've always had these biases against Haitians. You got to trace that back to the 1814, I think it was, Haitian Revolution, which was the first time in the history of the hemisphere, and I believe the world, where you actually had an enslaved people rise up and take control of a country. That really, you know, scared a lot of people in the United States, for right. instance. That led mm-hmm. to the ban on the importation of new slaves, which did not end slavery. Slavery just became more of a domestic industry, right? But Haiti was very powerful. And not just that, but giving, you know, the former slaves the right to participate in the control of the country. And that was met with a lot of pushback. And without getting into the history of slavery here, right. you know, to the modern times, it's involved coups against governments like the Aristide government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Haitians had to pay a debt back to France for the stolen property. But since the environment was already pretty much, you know, consumed and pretty wasted, you know, through, you know, colonial sugar plantations and so on. What was the French property? They were not really building a strong infrastructure. The French property were the bodies of the Haitians, you know? So, which Haiti then had to, and we're talking, you know, continued until the 1960s or later, I believe, paying off that debt, which is why Haiti is the poorest country in the hemisphere, because they were saddled, you know, for over a century, having to pay for their ancestors' bodies. So, you know, seeing Haitians as the group that is being targeted here, you know, is very disturbing. So, yeah, rhetorically divided us into an us and a them. And then, moving down the list, frame themselves, you know, the authoritarians, frame themselves, the us, as victims and a victimhood, right? So again, you know, that was very powerful, you know, for the Germans coming into power, because there was a legitimate victimhood, possibly, in, you know, what happened with the Treaty of Versailles and the end of World War I and so on. But in most places, this is a fictive victimhood, because by the time the Nazis were calling themselves victims, they weren't really talking about the Treaty of Versailles anymore. They were talking how they were being victimized by, and then it would be the people that they were themselves going to then wind up, you know, targeting with genocide. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what you have in the rise to authoritarianism is the people with the privilege claiming to be the victims. So, for instance, you see people with members of dominant religions talking about how their religions are being persecuted against, and that's why they need to end religious liberty for other people and things like that. So, or impose their religion by law on other people or their religious beliefs. So, moving down the list, then stoke fear and chaos while bathing themselves in the rhetoric of law and order. So
now we most certainly are seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you create like And J.D. Vance, in the vice presidential debate, kept saying this stuff, and it pretty much went unchallenged because there's a chaos factor. It was just kind of like a tidal wave of untrue things. So in order for, you know, Tim Walz to even have a voice of his own policy in there, he's just moving on and could not really just attack everything J.D. Vance said, because then the whole debate would be about J.D. Vance. And since we look at these things less as political debates and more as like pageants or like sporting competitions, you know, then he would have been declared. People were actually betting on who would be declared the winner of that thing. So he would be declared the loser because he was dominated by J.D. Vance, right? But, you know, so we have these mistruths out there. And this rhetoric of law and order, so J.D. Vance talks about the border being out of control when actually the border right now is pretty chill, mm-hmm. you know, for how the border has been at right. various different times, you know, including during the Trump presidency. So you create this rhetoric that we need law and order. And
the border always seems to be a go-to when a presidential election is coming up.
Yeah.
It's always border, border, border.
Right, because that is them, right? So you use terms like invasion,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's, if you start going into a lot of communities with large, you know, immigrant populations and refugee populations, migrant populations, you wind up with Republican leaders talking positively about how the migrants saved their economy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Utica, New York,
right,
which was quickly yeah. on its way to being nothing but a stain on the ground, you know. About, they have one section is about a mile of abandoned factories, and at some point, probably about 25 years ago, they got an influx of Bosnian immigrants who revitalized, you know, the heavily abandoned commercial strips, and they quickly, despite that being a conservative area now, you know, represented by a Republican in Congress, you know, they created an agency whose job was to attract more migrants to Utica and help them set up businesses. So that has turned that into a vibrant city with a dynamic cultural scene.
And Buffalo's West Side,
right.
10 years, less than a decade. Is
right. Now you compare that to some of the small ghost towns you're going to see around rural Texas, where they're very resistant, non-welcoming of immigrants, you know, just as an example.
Okay.
And you compare that to the dynamic, you know, rebirth that you see in Utica. So, you know, but around election time, you frame immigrants almost as if we're talking about a zombie-based TV show, you know, The Walking Dead, you know, and just hordes and hordes invading at the border. And there will be different political, you know, policy things that will cause different, you know, uneven flows of migrants. So you can get some kind of pictures of chaos that will happen where a first world country has a border with a third world country. But it's not an invasion. So, yeah, you stoke fears of chaos and then the rhetoric of law and order. And then you create and stoke anxiety and fear. And this is at moving to a whole different area around gender and sexual identity. And this is, you know, to a lot of people I mentioned, this is really surprising. You go back to Weimar Germany before the rise of the Nazis, and they had the world's foremost institute studying gender identity. So what we're talking, everything that we're looking at right now and recognizing transgender identities, transgender people have been around me all my life, but I didn't have the intellectual tools to recognize, you know, recognize their struggles mm-hmm. or their identities and what they were facing, you know, and try to increase their rights. Now we have those tools, but Weimar Germany was there, ahead of us, kind of. When the Nazis did book burnings, they burned the entire, you know, literary connection, all of the research, everything that was done on gender identities, plural, all different types of gender identities, you know, in Weimar Germany, and then came back with the rhetoric that they were fighting perversion, and then the perversion would be, you know, created by the people that are targeting his enemies. Putin used that as a reason for the invasion of Ukraine. Is that Ukraine had progressive LGBTQIA protections, right? There were out LGBTQIA communities in Ukraine, and that Putin, around the same time that he ordered the invasion of Ukraine, was criminalizing many aspects of, you know, queer identities.
And just to bring it back to our discussion, Project 25, and that's a big part of Project 25, is getting, basically ridding that classification.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I did a bunch of keyword searches too, which I'll talk about before we're done, you know, with regards to that. But with Putin, you know, he framed the invasion of Ukraine as Ukraine needing to be rescued from Western perversion, right? And this goes right back to what the Nazis were doing. And you start seeing there's this thing, they are rapists, they are going to rape our women. So you have this patriarchy, and you know, lean back into ultimately, and the reason why you have this big gender disparity in voting is because ultimately you use, you know, issues of gender and sexuality to get to the point that masculine privilege is being threatened. So then you get, but you don't put it that way.
Right.
So masculinity is being threatened. You know, so do you want your son to grow up to be a woman? You know, as this is a bad outcome. How can anybody want to be a woman? You know, it's like it all becomes part of the rhetoric. And if we hear it over and over again enough, it kind of like becomes, you know, this kind of hate-based stuff becomes a normal part of our discussion. So that's definitely, you know, and with regards to almost just about every authoritarian, you know, movement gets back to something about creating gender and sexual anxiety. And then you use biblical terms of good and evil. And you don't use biblical terms in North Korea, so that would be, so this one is not universal, but generally, almost universally, you know, you have a religious component to the rise of authoritarianism. You're, at the very least, you're excluding, you know, them religions. And you're enforcing and, you know, us religions and giving us religions political power and so on. So, you know, use biblical terms of good and evil, with the us group being good and them being evil.
Let's use this moment to take in our final time out.
Okay.
On What's Next. Dr. Michael Nyman with us here on What's Next. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Lawmakers, assemble! Corey here with some compact civics. Ever hear of a state assembly? It's not some type of superhero league you might be thinking of. The state assembly is the lower chamber of the New York State Legislature, responsible for creating laws, setting the state budget, and overseeing various public policy areas. Since all the way back in 1777, they've been working with the Gov and the rest of the state Senate to do all of that. But it's also a platform where significant figures have started their political journeys. Former presidents like Theodore Roosevelt and Millard Fillmore, and even Senator of New York Chuck Schumer, have served in the assembly. These assembly folks manage our taxes, education, health, transportation, the environment, and worker protections, ensuring the state's smooth functioning. Whew. Most other state legislatures are bicameral, with an upper and lower chamber, and they have names you've heard of: House of Representatives and Senate. So, while the concept of lower legislative chambers exists in other states, it may not always be called an assembly. But of course, New York rolls like that.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
Hey, educators, you've been asking for it, and it's here. Reading Rainbow Stories is ready to help your students stay on track. Each story is paired with activities to help students strengthen cross-curricular skills such as math and business in Lemonade for Sale.
Let's keep track of our sales.
Science and health in Germs Make Me Sick.
Usually, you feel better after a day or two.
Thanks.
But if you don't, you should see a doctor.
And history in Following the Drinking Gourd.
One of the worst things about slavery is that families were separated. Fathers, mothers, and children were oftentimes sold to different people.
Check out the new Reading Rainbow Stories collection on PBS Learning Media today to help your students stay on track.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And we're back with What's Next, Thomas O'Neill White and Jay Moran, here with Dr. Michael Nyman. We were talking about authoritarianism in relation to Project 2025, but you wanted to get into erasing history.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Jason Stanley, whose work I was referring to earlier, came out with a new book, which is also an excellent tool. It's called Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Stanley gives us a plethora of historical and contemporary examples to show how authoritarians, which he argues can be more clearly identified as fascists, all create mythic pasts where the us descends from greatness and the them from barbarism, right? So the problem, though, with creating a make-believe past is that you have to first erase the real past.
Mm-hmm.
A great nation would not have been built, you know, on the stolen labor of brutally enslaved peoples and stolen land, for instance. So we need to have a mythic past to replace our real past. So it becomes an attack on history. You can't really divorce black history from American history. The enslavement of black people built the wealth that still powers our country, still powers our economy. Black political activism powered our historic movements for democracy and continues to power them today. So, you know, teaching about the struggles to create democracy, you know, undermines the myths that we came out of the gate as a democracy in 1776. So this becomes problematic for people who are trying to create a mythic past, make Germany great again. You know, to erase history, you need to attack the teaching of history in the classroom and the documentary, you know, the documenting of history in books and in libraries. So to erase history, you have to erase the teaching of history and the books that people use to teach history. It's in this context that we need to look at Project 2025 and the proposal to eliminate the Department of Education. Now, there's a lot of stuff in that proposal, but I'm really focusing on a few things here today.
Okay.
That clears the path for a president to, as 2025 clearly articulates, end programs and educational institutions that promote inclusion and try to address disparity. Again, I have a hard time saying it, you know, that here is a plan to end programs, you know, in public schools, colleges, universities, you know, end programs that promote inclusion and try to address disparity. Suddenly, inclusion becomes a controversial word.
Mm.
Why? Why do they want to do this? Because any discussion of disparity, of oppression, of racism, exclusion, xenophobia, genderphobia, etc., it all undermines a mythology of us and our greatness. We're not always great, right? So in this context, Project 2025 becomes a strategic framework of performative anti-intellectualism. It establishes an intellectual framework for erasing critical intellectual examinations of American history. So again, you know, Vance, Yale-educated, you know, venture capitalist, quite wealthy, becomes a man of the people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
An anti-intellectual.
Yeah, but he just described what would be normally considered an elite.
An elite,
yes.
I'll tell you, no disrespect, but you know, his academic pedigree is certainly, you know, shinier than any of ours, right?
Well,
so, you know,
right.
But yet, you know, he is a poster face for this anti-intellectualism, which is actually a well-thought-out intellectual attack on critical intellectualism. On a micro level, Project 2024 lays out specific details on how a presidential remaking of education would proceed. On the first day in office, this imperial president would, according to Project 2024, you know, issue a decree to redefine the word sex ambiguously as a term to refer to a fixed biological fact of sorts.
Right? Of sorts.
Of sorts. Well, I put in the of sorts, okay. Right? You know, so that, you know, just, and they write, just redefine the word sex to refer to a fixed biological fact, you know, rather than referring to a person's sexuality. So sex goes down to a biological fact as opposed to a person's sexuality. In an Orwellian twist, Project 2025, and again, this is looking at it on a granular level, it would take us sitting here for a week to go through the whole 920 pages.
Right.
But looking at it on a granular level, Project 2025 proposes a list of words and terms slated for elimination in federal laws and regulations. These include the terms sexual orientation, gender identity, diversity, equity, DEI as an abbreviation, meaning, mm-hmm. you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, gender equality, gender equity, gender awareness, gender sensitive, reproductive health, and reproductive rights,
wow.
right? Slated for elimination. And that list, we're only on page 5 of the 920 pages by the time you get to this list. Later in the document, they contradict themselves, reintroducing terms such as gender equity, but with new dystopian definitions for them. So it's worse than just eliminating the words. It's eliminating and reintroducing them with different meaning, mm-hmm. kind of like what they did with fake news. Fake news referring to any news that you know, sheds light on what it is that they don't want people to see.
Right.
So, like, here's a quote from Project 2025. Rescind regulations prohibiting the discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, transgender status, and sex characteristics. So you can kind of, like, use the words if you're talking about eliminating protections and rights.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, you know, coming into, you know, 2025 after the election with a new president, and we see major initiatives not to protect our democracy and our rights, but to go further, taking our rights away from us. Eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion programs is a Project 2024 obsession with 39 references to the acronym DEI. And that's without getting into using the terms and the words. The report also attacks the use of terms like white privilege and intersectionality. Project 2025 gets granular, specifically addressing things like rainbow flags and Black Lives Matter flags, which, you know, shouldn't be flown on federal properties. So, well, 2025's authors, you know, they begin with a big tent for the US group. Everybody's welcome. So you wind up with really interesting identities like white supremacists of color. You know, and so a big tent for the US group, it's pretty clear who the them is.
Mm-hmm.
The report is replete with microaggressions, such as addressing, you know, capital B, Black Americans, as lowercase small b, Black Americans, differentiating Black folks somehow and Black Americans from, say, Irish Americans, capitalized, Jewish Americans, Italian Americans, all capitalized identities. You know, Black folks only get a capital B in the plan that I've, you know, looked through when the plan is calling for the banning of Black Lives Matter flags. That's where we get a capital B for Black folks. Rainbow flags also banned, but, you know, there's a lot of similarities, you know, with Trump policies. Also, if I can get into that for a moment.
We've got about five or six minutes.
I'll go quick on this one.
Yes. All right.
So while Trump distances himself from Project 2025, the point is moot, as many of Trump's policy statements echo the plan or the plan echoes them.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not they're actually working in tandem, they're very similar. So, for example, I'll just give four examples here. Trump calls for cutting the federal funding for schools teaching critical race theory, gender studies, or what he says, quote, other inappropriate racial, sexual, and political content on our children.
Mm.
Trump's plans on his website, you know, calls for creating a credentialing body to certify teachers, quote, who embrace patriotic values, which aren't really defined, rather than, quote, indoctrinate children. Trump calls for a purge of, quote, radicals, zealots, and Marxists from the Department of Education. Project 2024 goes one step further and calls for the elimination of the Department of Education.
Yeah, altogether, you know? Right.
Trump wants to, quote, keep men out of women's sports. I mean, like that's the whole, you know, meaning of women's sports, that it's for women. You know, so that's not really something that you need to say. But I think in this case, he seems to be like using men as a slur against transgender women.
Right.
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 So again,
we saw that during the Olympics this
right,
or the summer.
Yeah. So just going in there, you know, with kind of like name calling against, you know, and you know, scapegoating transgender folks. So, yeah, there's similarities. Whether or not we want to do the detective work to actually prove, you know, a connection between Trump and the plan, the plan seems to echo what Trump is doing, and Trump seems to echo what the plan is doing, and Trump has a very strong, you know, track record in his time in office as president, where he gave the Heritage Foundations 2/3 of what they were looking for. So
I had a question that's kind of a little off topic, but has to do with the, you know, presidential campaign of Kamala Harris. So wanted your thoughts on, you know, neoconservative support of the Harris campaign. You know, Dick Cheney has come out in support of the Harris and Waltz campaign. Just want your thoughts on that.
Well, I think you kind of answered the question in the question in that the neoconservatives, they're not fascists. And I think that, you know, Dick Cheney, now I say they're not fascists when they're saying, like, in my youth with great hyperbole, you know, I might have called them fascists.
Right.
But, you know,
right. Yeah.
They're not fascists per se.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Cheney has said that he has a great number of strong policy disagreements with Kamala Harris. But he sees Donald Trump as a quintessential threat to the continuation of democracy and fears that with another Donald Trump term, we won't have a democracy. And that's also, you know, there's 200 military and police officials, people in leadership roles that echoed that statement after Cheney came out. Most of whose policies I may not agree with or agree with, but they also are people all who took an oath of office and, mm-hmm. you know, to protect the Constitution. And they see another Donald Trump presidency. And I believe, you know, Project 2025, you know, becomes part of that package, you know, as a quintessential threat to democracy.
And yet there are, and just to follow up then on that concept, so many of the Republican Party, so many people who identify as Republicans have jumped in and jumped onto this path.
There's been a takeover of the Republican Party by people who previously didn't identify themselves as Republicans, like, you know, Donald Trump, who was a lifelong Democrat,
liberal,
you know, for most of his life still was a Democrat, you know, Trump's base, you know, all jumped in there to the point that a Republican who does not kiss Donald Trump's ring, who's not a sycophant, you know, can't win a primary. So I wouldn't condemn all Republicans. I can just say the Republicans who don't buy into this program have pretty much been exiled from the party. So it's a whole new thing, this Republican Party. It certainly is not, you know, it certainly isn't supporting conservative economic, you know, ideas that Republicans previously stood for.
And that will do it for this episode of What's Next. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Michael Nyman from Buffalo State University. You're listening to WBFO News and Buffalo, Toronto Public Media.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.